Today is Thursday, November 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Zimbabwe's incoming president returns from exile. Russia takes the lead in talks to end Syria's close to seven-year civil war.
This is all part of the campaign of Vladimir Putin to make Russia again a great and superpower in the world.
A major change could be coming to rules regarding internet use in the United States. Also ahead, millions of Americans are celebrating Thanksgiving. We'll explain what the holiday is all about. It's all on today's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin won the backing of Turkey and Iran on Wednesday to host a Syrian peace conference in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, taking a central role in the diplomatic ending the close of 7 years of civil war that's left hundreds of thousands dead. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Jonathan Adelman, University of Denver professor of international affairs, if this move will undercut the UN Geneva peace process.
Oh, absolutely. Iran is, an authoritarian, radically Islamic state. Russia used to be a communist state, and now it's very authoritarian. And unfortunately, Turkey, which used to be under Kemal Atatürk and his successors, moving towards some version of democracy and some version of capitalism, is also moving in the wrong direction. So if these are the winners, then problems are going to continue to mount in the Middle East.
Will the opposition show up?
Well, the problem is the opposition needs help. And the core problem, for example, the Kurds, and the United States has not been, talks about the Kurds, but and then has done some arming of them, but nothing that would compare to dealing with 600,000 man army like the Turks have, or several hundred thousand people and soon nuclear weapons that the Iranians have, and the Russians have 7,000 atomic nuclear bombs. So, unfortunately, we haven't really been committed in all of this. And the sad thing is 450,000 people, civilians, have been killed and 25% of the population displaced abroad. I mean, this is serious, and we're not paying much attention to it right now.
Israel has warned that a greater Iranian influence will be a danger to the region. Will this situation create basically an opportunity for Iran to deepen its influence in Syria right on the border of Israel?
No, absolutely. And the Russians have refused to say, as the Israelis asked them, to keep that border at least 20 or 30 miles away. They're talking about 3 to 5 miles, which is almost guaranteed. I'll be in Israel in 2 weeks. I've been there 11 times. And the Israelis are just not going to put up with it. They've already attacked about 100 times, reinforcements, sending more modern weapons to Hezbollah. And if this turns out that way, then we're just going to have not the end of war in the Middle East. But don't forget the Saudis. They have been very worried about this, too, and so too have the other Sunni states. So instead of this being the end, this historically will probably be viewed as just the very beginning.
What is the broader objective of Russia in developing this conference and its vision of the Middle East?
They've wanted to come back, whether it is in parts of western Ukraine, whether it's in Crimea, whether it is in Georgia, and now in a victory in Syria. This is all part of the campaign of Vladimir Putin to make Russia again a great and superpower in the world. And so for the Russians, it's easy to understand what they want out of it. And they haven't had much losses, but they've supplied just that margin that the other side needed to win. And even now, they really haven't totally won, but they're going to win at the rate they're going.
The opposition met Wednesday in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. According to a report, they will stick to their demand that Bashar al-Assad go as part of a transition, but they're in a very weakened state. The head of the High Negotiations Committee stepped down just a couple of days before this meeting in Saudi Arabia. The opposition is in a weak position. It's fractured. Should it be demanding that Assad first leave?
I don't think actually the Russians particularly love Assad either, but they want him as a figurehead. And given the fact of 11 million people being murdered, displaced, or actually leaving the country, they'll need him as a symbol. But the reality is that if this new coalition continues, there's going to be some kind of major crisis in the Middle East, because the Israelis Israel's very small. It's 8,000 square miles. And the Saudis' problem is they don't have a very strong military. and neither does the United Arab Emirates or much of the rest of the Sunni Middle East. So the United States is going to have to make a decision because it's been focused on Iranian nuclear weapons, and that's an important issue. But this conventional war that could come up could be extraordinarily violent and really with a lot of spillover into Africa and even parts of southern eastern Mediterranean.
The U.S. has forces on the ground in Syria, of course, helping rebels combat Islamic State, but that fight is nearly over. Diplomatically, the U.S. is nowhere to be found in this peace process.
That's right. We really don't know whether it's because of the new administration or the previous administration, but very clearly what's being missed right now with all, and now even more with scandals, which are a serious issue in American politics, and other things, worrying about the 2018 election, it's almost been pushed off. If you listen to the president today, he gave a list of four or five things that he was concerned about, and he left out Iran. And if you were the Saudis, you would be wondering, what about the alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States? They can't do it without us.
Well, that's Jonathan Adelman, University of Denver, Professor of International Affairs. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson calls the violence against Rohingya in Myanmar ethnic cleansing. Bosnians welcome Mladic's conviction, but justice is unlikely to reconcile the divided region. Missing Argentine sub may be running out of air, and the Kremlin vows to defend Russian oligarch who's under arrest in France. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. A former confidant of ousted Zimbabwe leader Robert Mugabe is promising a new unfolding democracy and reaching out to the world for international help rebuilding the country's shattered economy. Zimbabwe's Parliament Speaker said for Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa will be sworn in as the country's new president on Friday, taking over following the resignation of Mugabe. Beverly Peters is professor at American University School of Professional and Extended Studies. She tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about Mugabe's history of holding on to power despite controversy.
We saw through his 37 years in power that he was able to consolidate his position time and time again, eliminating opposition, conducting suspect elections, engaging in power-sharing mechanisms that weren't real power-sharing mechanisms, alienating opposition leaders and opposition parties and anybody within ZANU-PF that didn't agree with him.
He took over a country that was known as the breadbasket of Africa, and yet he really drove the economy into the ground.
Absolutely. There's a myriad of different reasons that the Zimbabwe economy is where it is now. I think after the liberation struggle in 1980, things were very positive. And if you go back and look at Robert Mugabe's speeches, he spoke quite eloquently about bringing the population together, working together, building a better Zimbabwe, redressing those colonial imbalances, dealing with land reform. And all of that seemed to fade away within the first decade of his rule. Sure, in 1980, 1985, the country was a breadbasket. It was exporting. The economy was vibrant. But over time, corruption and mismanagement seemed to permeate every layer of the economy, including that land reform program that was so crucial to redress those imbalances that took place during colonialism.
What finally led in this latest crisis that finally led to the fact that there was no way that Mugabe could continue to power?
I think you had a situation where the economy was in a free fall. The economy is devastated. People knew that Mugabe was 93 years old. They knew something else was coming. They knew that there would be some sort of change within that presidency. His move to fire Vice President Mnangagwa was the straw that broke the camel's back, as it were. Analysts felt as if he was placing his wife, Grace Mugabe, in a position to take over as the president in the elections that will come in July or August of next year. And that was really the catalyst that started this soft coup, if you will, and the resignation of Mugabe.
That's Beverly Peters, professor at American University School of Professional and Extended Studies. Kyu Hyung family had her family had everything in Vietnam, or his, I should say. He owned a hotel, had a car, food, and money. But it all changed with the end of the Vietnam War, when he and his family had to flee to the United States. And eventually, he became a billionaire in his new country. As Elizabeth Lee tells us, when devastating floods hit California and Texas this year, Hyung found a way to give back to his new home.
Music has a way of bringing comfort and normalcy. That's the case for retiree Sang Trang and his wife. Floodwaters forced them to flee their home more than 8 months ago.
2 days after the flooding, when the water receded, I came home and found everything damaged. I felt so sorry for myself, as I'm not working anymore, and I do not know how I could afford stuff.
Elizabeth Arredondo and her family were forced out of their home for 2 months.
It made me really sad to think that we no longer had anything.
This entire neighborhood was underwater. Most of the residents who live here are low-income immigrants from Vietnam and Latin America.
14,000 people in San Jose had to evacuate from the flood. But help came when San Jose's mayor received a phone call from Kyu Hyung.
He said, I'm in for $5 million. But his mandate was clear and it was perfect. It's exactly what we needed. No strings attached, but every dollar was going to go to the victims, and it did.
Hyung also donated $5 million to flood relief in Houston when Hurricane Harvey hit.
We have to be grateful to the United States of America, to the people who allow us to come into the country to be successful. So now this is the time we pay back.
At the end of the Vietnam War, Hyung and his family fled to Los Angeles as refugees.
In Vietnam, we had everything. I own hotel. I have a car, I have a house, things like that. But when I left, I have nothing left. You got it? And so we must do our best in any circumstance or any situation. We have to think how to survive.
Hyung survived on $1.25 an hour, working at Abbott Labs and other odd jobs. Eventually, he founded his own blood plasma company that included 11 centers in the U.S., He expanded into China and built Shanghai RAAS, becoming the company's majority shareholder. But the Chinese blood plasma business has been riddled with controversy. And for Hyung, success came with a price.
In this kind of blood business, we have competition everywhere.
He says his competitors tried to discredit him.
They tried to say, this is our product is bad. This is that China product. So this is the kind of thing I tell you, I hate it.
Hyung says these accusations are wrong and upsetting, so he is focusing on other business ventures and plans to continue helping people like he did in San Jose, where Hyung's donation not only helped flood victims pay for temporary housing.
We also were able to use that funding for car donations, for car repairs, for household items.
Hyung's donation helped Trang buy another car so he can perform his music in his community. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, San Jose.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. As we turn now to what's trending on social media, we hear from VOA's Andrew Palchewski.
Well, the big story today is hashtag net neutrality. The idea of net neutrality is that internet service providers can't charge more money for certain websites or services. And that's actually a policy that was instituted under the Obama administration. But with the Trump administration and the new Federal Communications Commission chairman, Ajit Pai, they have signaled that they would like to repeal that. So it is a big win for internet service providers. They can charge, for instance, more money for people who want to watch faster videos or people who want to access, say, a movie website like Netflix. For a lot of content creators and internet users, this has become a big point of contention. They say it's going to hurt consumers. It's going to cost them more money to get online and use the services that previously have been equal. So we're seeing a lot of talk about that on social media as they plan next month to vote to repeal those regulations. A lot of lobbying on behalf of companies like Netflix, YouTube, other services that allow people to create online content. They'd like to see net neutrality stay in place so that they are not penalized for doing these different services. But that is a big point of talking on conversation on social media today. Of course, the other big story here in the United States is Thanksgiving, and we're seeing a lot of talk on social media about just that, about the traveling, whether it's the traffic on the roads, the lines at the airport, people trying to get from point A to point B with few delays as possible. And social media has actually become a big asset for a lot of folks checking traffic reports and reports about delays, weather delays, making sure their flights and trains and all other modes of transportation get out on time. But I think later we're going to begin to see that shift. And as people get home, we're going to see a lot more posts about people reuniting with family and friends as they prepare to celebrate tomorrow. And of course, all of the posts about the foods that people are looking forward to. We'll have more about Thanksgiving on the holiday tomorrow. But for right now, the preparation continues, and that's reflected on social media.
All right, Andrew, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving. And you can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, as Andrew said, today is the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States, a day centered around a big meal and usually with family. The holiday dates back to 1621 when the Plymouth colonists and the Wampanoag Indians shared an autumn harvest feast that's acknowledged today as one of the first Thanksgiving celebrations in the colonies. Nowadays, it's a day to give thanks, enjoy good food and time with family, and it's the start of the Christmas shopping season. VOA's Korean service visited a grocery store just outside Washington to explain how people prepare for the big day. Brian Allen narrates.
More than 50 million Americans are expected to travel during this Thanksgiving, most to spend the holiday with family and friends.
So this year we're going to have our family come in from Morgantown, West Virginia, and Wednesday night my wife flies in from Iceland, so we're going to be cooking all night Wednesday and all early morning Thursday. We're going to have about 11 or 12 kids in our house with four adults, so it's going to be quite a party.
In advance of the holiday, which is celebrated every year on the fourth Thursday of November, grocery stores are crowded with customers stocking up to prepare for the big feast.
So far, just the produce and things like that. So I still need to go and get some of the stuff to make the pies and ingredients for that, so the baking section. Oh, yes, I do not shop close to Thanksgiving. It's too stressful. So many people.
At the center of Thanksgiving dinner is the turkey. 45 million are sold every Thanksgiving season. That is about 18% of annual turkey consumption on one day. Turkey and many of the traditional side dishes on a Thanksgiving menu are sold here at a Wegmans food market.
This is an item that has all your components to Thanksgiving, your stuffing, your butternut squash, your mashed potatoes, your honey brined roasted turkey, cranberry sauce, everything that you need for one person. So we bump that quantity up to two as well as three.
According to the American Farm Bureau, the average cost of a turkey dinner for 10 people in the U.S. is just under $50. For VOA's Korean service, Brian Allen, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In September 2015, NASA said they had confirmed evidence of liquid water flowing on present-day Mars. The space agency said their Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter identified the chemical signature of hydrated salts and minerals in mysterious dark streaks that are seen flowing down the slopes of a number of Martian hills, mountains, and craters. But a new study suggests that the evidence supporting the existence of water on the Red Planet was misinterpreted. The study proposes that the dark streaks called recurring slope lineae are now understood as being the result of dry, granular flows of sand and dust from recurring avalanches. U.S. Geological Survey scientist and study lead author Colin Dundas says that the new findings suggest that the surface of Mars is quite dry today. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, racial inequality in post-war America and civil rights activism are prevalent themes in Hollywood films this season. Using gritty cinematography and A-list actors, directors such as Kathryn Bigelow, George Clooney, and Dan Gilroy shed light on the history of racial injustice in America and open up the conversation about racial tensions in the present. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
It's a war zone out there.
The film drama Detroit by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Kathryn Bigelow is based on the 1967 riots that tore apart the city of Detroit.
These riots, this was an anger that was building and was on a collision course in 1967.
Major American cities such as Detroit became the battleground for discontented African Americans facing unemployment and racial discrimination in housing and education. Bigelow focuses on a chain of events one night during the riots that led police to brutalize a group of innocent African Americans.
When I went in there, three kids had been killed.
No. So they were killed right before you got there.
Sir.
You carry a 38, right?
Police officers attempt to incriminate an African-American security guard who witnessed the events at the hotel and tried to intervene to defuse the situation. John Boyega plays real-life security guard Melvin Dismukes.
I need you to survive the night. He was an unspoken guardian angel to those boys that were there.
Police!
Detroit combines a cinema verite approach with taut drama. Weaving historic footage into dramatic sequences, the film immerses us into the riots as a pivotal moment of systemic racial injustice and repression in America.
My hope is that the film could maybe stimulate greater conversation.
From the inner city, we move to the white American suburbs of the 1950s with George Clooney's dark satire, Suburbicon.
Nothing like this ever happened here.
This is a safe place.
It was.
Like Bigelow, Clooney uses real-life racial tensions as a counterpoint to his murder mystery, which takes place in the all-white suburb of Levittown, Pennsylvania.
I could kill you, too.
A corrupt middle executive played by Matt Damon is getting away with murder while the community focuses its attention and indignation against the Myers, the first African-American family to move into Levittown. George Clooney says when they were making the film, President Donald Trump had not yet been elected and the racial intolerance that surfaced in Charlottesville had not taken place.
It was in the middle of the campaign. And it seemed like it was fun to talk about and remind people that these are not new subjects.
Mr. Ramirez was told he was not under arrest, and yet he was refused use of the bathroom. That's a violation of civil rights.
You can wait and address.
In Roman J. Israel Esquire, filmmaker Dan Gilroy crafts a character drama that targets institutionalized racism through a corrupt judicial system. The story takes place in today's Los Angeles and revolves around Roman, a socially awkward lawyer.
Finding contempt.
Played by Denzel Washington, Roman comes face to face with an overburdened justice system which disproportionately affects African Americans. Everybody looking at you crazy. Filmmaker Dan Gilroy says his story, like his character, is reminiscent of the political activism of the 1960s and 70s.
The story spoke to me on a very contemporary level. There are things going on right now, legally, constitutionally, nationally and internationally, that the story just became a focus.
Despite their different methodologies, all three films address racial tensions, but also the potential for racial reconciliation and tolerance. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, a year of events of marking the 100th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's birth came to a close on Wednesday. Solemn commemorations came exactly 54 years after Kennedy's assassination in Dallas, Texas, in 1963. Over the past year, numerous conferences and other events have been held worldwide to examine the 35th president's legacy and imagine his impact. Would he have survived? You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the fourth Thursday in November, Americans celebrate Thanksgiving. The celebration is rooted in the ancient tradition of the Harvest Festival, but in the United States it has taken a far greater significance. Although there are numerous regional claims as to where the first Thanksgiving was celebrated, the traditional observance stems from a celebration that took place in Massachusetts in November 1621. Those English settlers who celebrated that first Thanksgiving truly did have much for which to be thankful. Known today as the Pilgrims, these Christians were dissenters from the established English church. As part of their religious beliefs, they observed days of fasting and days of thanksgiving in response to events they believed to be special acts of providence. The end of a drought or of a plague might call for a day of thanksgiving. Intent on setting up a community wherein they could live according to their own religious beliefs, they sailed out of England on a ship called the Mayflower in September 1620. 102 would-be colonists and some 30 crew came ashore at Cape Cod on November 9th. Within a year, half of them were dead due to starvation, disease, and the harsh weather conditions of that first winter. But the summer brought a good harvest, and in autumn, 53 pilgrims sat down to a feast with 90 of their neighbors, Wampanoag Indians, who had helped feed and safeguard them over their first year in the New World. Although the holiday had been observed in Virginia since the first permanent colony was founded in Jamestown in 1609, modern Thanksgiving was first officially established in all states in 1863 by a presidential proclamation of Abraham Lincoln. The observance was moved to the fourth week in November by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Thanksgiving began as a prayer of gratitude by immigrants who faced death, who nevertheless came through and endured. Today, for many Americans, it is an occasion for gatherings of family and friends, a day to share a holiday meal with those who matter the most, and a day to give thanks for the many blessings of freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.